Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Another week, another set of issues on the campaign trail for the presidential candidates, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, immigration getting a lot of attention at this time, as it has throughout the campaign and likely will till this is all over. So let's pull it apart a little bit. Joining me, wonderful expert, Dr. Philip Beverly. He's a professor over at Chicago State University, where he is a professor of political science. We've had the pleasure of doing both my Politics Tonight TV show and a little radio over on the Beyond the Beltway show, and I sat in for host Bruce Dumont. And so I said, please join me on the podcast. And Philip, you have, and I appreciate you.
Thanks for inviting me, Paul.
So as we get into this, let's talk about immigration at first. Now, you know, the ultimate component of Donald Trump's elements of his program, not quite yet known as we're creating this podcast. So we'll have to do a little speculating. But that said, his surrogates certainly have taken to the airs and basically said, you know what, he hasn't changed his position. If you think you're hearing change, it's you. Don't listen to your lying ears. It's you. It's not him. How truthful is that?
With the Donald, it's really hard to fathom until you start to hear some specifics about it. He's stuck between having to deal with some rationality around immigration reform and really catering to the base that really propelled him through this primary and convention process, that really want to see something impactful around immigration. And it's going to be tough for him to sort of navigate those waters in a way that I think appeals to the more centrist or what we would call independent voters.
Well, so here's the thing. When the surrogates have been saying he hasn't changed his position, they can then, you know, rally off a bunch of points where that's true. He never backs down from building the wall. He never backs down from Mexico's going to pay for it, though that's never going to happen. He doesn't back down from several of the pieces. The whole issue, the whole question of has he backed away, is this issue of deporting 11 million or whatever the exact number is, illegal immigrants who are in this country. The back off seems to be now he wants to go after the bad ones, suggesting that there are good ones. Although, wouldn't it be true if you're here illegally, you are a criminal? And I'm not taking a position on this. I'm simply making the theoretical argument. That's what we do. But if you are going to say we're only going after the bad ones, well, technically they're all bad because they're all here illegally.
Yeah, he's going to, I think, really nuance that. And I would imagine pivot back to the rapist and murderers comments that he made earlier in the election cycle. But I think really focus on those who are already committed crimes and haven't been deported yet. And I think there'll be, if you can call it a softening, I would imagine it would be around the family issue. Because I think he was challenged pretty significantly on, so do you want to break up families? And what's he say to that? Oh, yeah, I want to have parents get their kids stripped away from them because the kid was born here and the parent wasn't. And, you know, it is a much more difficult situation than sound bites will afford. So I think he's going to just pivot to, oh, yeah, the criminals, and leave out the part that anyone here who came as an undocumented worker or person has broken the law. But nuance that, but that's not a violent crime.
So if I understood what you said in your previous answer to me, you said, well, it's going to be difficult for him to get to the more centrist people on this issue, the moderates. But the truth is that this modification of his plan to do what you just articulated, that is the appeal to the centrists, right? I mean, I think the folks he risks jeopardizing is the true base of his support, the ones who want all 11 million out of here tomorrow.
And that's the dance that he has to do here. So how does he maintain the base and the independent votes?
How does he give a wink and a nod to that base? Because I agree with you, he's got to soften it, but he doesn't want to lose the base. So somehow he has to say things which are often the analysts pull apart as going, it's a wink and a nod. They know what he's saying. They realize what he can't say.
Yeah. And the thing is, if you have a disciplined candidate who can do that, that's one thing, but he's not a disciplined candidate. And so I guess I'm just waiting for the explosion of what he really thinks, and all the softening and all the sort of rational approach to this is all for naught. And then he loses those sort of independent, more centrist voters.
Well, I know things can change, but ever since Kellyanne Conway came on board to replace Paul Manafort, He's been in teleprompter land, which I kind of love because all he used to do was attack Hillary Clinton for using a teleprompter. Now he uses a teleprompter all the time, and now apparently it's okay, but fine. but my point is, when you sort of say, I'm waiting for him to kind of do his thing, my question is, will he? Or does he now realize, as he watched the polls and more recent polls as this week goes on, he's closing the gap? So he's making a movement. And I think part of it is because he's not out there ranting and raving and doing his thing. He seems to be controlled through his teleprompter, which means speech written by somebody else.
And yet, how disciplined can he be to maintain that? Because I think we've seen sort of flashes of that throughout the campaign, where he would offer prepared remarks or would stay on message, which for him seemed to be a little challenging. And then he's back to the old Donald. And now they changed the management team there at Team Trump, and he seems to be sort of a little bit more disciplined. And how long can he maintain that? I mean, I think there's really a lot of pressure on him to stay disciplined more than anything. And I don't know that he holds up to that pressure, because he, at the end of the day, is going to be the man that he is.
Well, I agree, although, I'm kind of wondering whether or not, you know, I've talked a lot on our WGN airways about, this is going back months, but that when we hit the general election, you know, he would pivot, and as everybody does when it comes to a general election, and of course he didn't, and the morning anchors would say, well, Paul, where's the pivot? And hey, mea culpa, I guess he's not pivoting, and even Trump said, I am who I am, and I'm not gonna pivot, but he is.
Isn't that the interesting thing about his popularity among his base, is that they like that sort of shoot from the hip thing, that he gets to speak some of the things that they think but don't have a venue or an outlet to say. And I think it might make them a little bit more uncomfortable if he looks too staged, because they see that that's not who he is.
I also think they're right. I mean, I think part of the compromise that they have. Now, I'm not in that room when it happens, as they say in Hamilton. But I have a feeling that he probably sat down with his new advisors and said, look, I have to be who I am. And they probably said, Mr. Trump, we're going to write for your speaking style. Because the truth is, once in a while, lately, when I hear him, I have to take a moment and wonder, is he on teleprompter or isn't he? And I thought, that's the sign that they're doing a great job. They are writing to his style, and yet it's scripted.
And, you know, before the adage about politics for the presidential race doesn't start until after Labor Day. So we're getting ready to run up on that. And I wonder what happens in terms of the pressure for him after Labor Day, say in the next sort of 4 weeks or so as we roll into October. Is he going to be able to be not just staying on the teleprompter, but being presidential, showing that he has some grasp of the complexity of the job, which he hadn't really done a good job with up to this point. And so are they going to be able to sort of school him in that? I don't know. And as that pressure builds, you know, who do you sort of put your money on? Hillary Clinton, for whatever she may be, not the most inspiring or whatever,
yeah,
she's a very disciplined candidate.
Well,
she's going to stay on message.
And really, where those styles meet will be in the debates. We'll get there. But let's take a moment and talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton and the issues she's having. You know, one of the things, I give Trump credit on this one, they seem to be doing, through him or his surrogates, the daily count on how many days it's been since Hillary Clinton has held a press conference. And, you know, and pretty soon it won't be far from being saying it's a year since she's held a press conference. I won't get that far, but, you know, you ain't that far from it. I understand why she doesn't want to deal with the press. She knows the tough questions, but isn't that sort of amazing? While they put attention to it, I have a feeling if it was Trump who wasn't doing a press conference for the 280, 290 days this thing grows into, the press would be going crazy. But for some reason, they don't seem to put the same pressure on Hillary.
They don't. There's been almost given her a pass on doing that. And I don't know if it's the relationships that the Clinton machine has built over the years with the decision makers in newsrooms or what. And maybe it's, I hate to say this, maybe it's easier to sort of cover Mr. Trump, because you sort of figure you're going to get something interesting from him. And what would you really be getting from Hillary in a press conference?
Yeah, but Philip, that's what, you know, every time I hear liberal media, and I think it's just so ridiculous. And by the way, I get hate email from both sides of the aisle. Last week, somebody asking me if I was paid by the Clinton Foundation, and just days later, somebody saying you're a Republican hack. So I know I'm doing a good job if I'm getting everybody angry. My thing is here, it feeds the liberal media view if, in fact, we have to sit and say, yeah, they are giving her a pass. Maybe they just have a great relationship. That's not right.
I'm at a loss. I'm really at a loss. I mean, I get there's a piece about you use the economic view of sort of your exposure. The less exposure you have, sort of the more valuable it is, right? It's like, oh, there's going to be a press conference. Is she sort of saving this to deliver some major announcement? Is she saving this to preempt him from making some major announcement? Because once it does happen, the press is going to run to cover her and not him, given that he's gotten $3 billion worth of free media during his
campaign? Well, he makes news every time he opens his mouth. And she, of course, you know, the problem with Hillary in terms of her answers, she will always make sense when she gives them. You have to almost process it, do a little investigation, and then you got to get back to her to go, now, what you said wasn't true. But you don't seem to catch her at the moment. You got to kind of go, I got to check this.
Yeah, her legal training, I think, is good. As attorneys are supposed to be skilled in that way.
How stupid.
Think on your feet.
How stupid, let me reword that. How important is it that the Clintons step in and, as the New York Times has recently called for and said, you know what, you got to stop accepting foreign donations, you got to stop doing this stuff, and you need to be doing it now. What I was going to say is, how stupid is it that they would wait until the results of a general election when this is just a headline that it won't go away and needs to and could.
I'm shocked that they hadn't done it already. As politically sophisticated as they are, and knowing how the attack is going to come at them, that's just one that I would have expected they would have cut off any kind of avenue of approach to their enemies, and they didn't. And they leave it laying in the field to be pounced on. And that's just remarkable to me that they've done that.
Let's turn for a few minutes to the debates before we wrap. And the big question in everybody's mind, I think, is which Donald Trump do we expect to see? There are those who think we will see the more moderated, teleprompting kind of Donald Trump try and answer the questions. I still think, look out, the crooked Hillarys, the Trump, as you say, that's sort of always there and always inside. I think that Trump comes out, maybe in a slightly different way, but I think it comes out.
I think it comes out no matter what he tries to do, and I'm sure that Team Trump is going to get some really good surrogates for Hillary in the debate prep and try and give him a sense of what this is about. I know he had the benefit of the Republican debates, but that this is a very different sort of venue for him.
Yeah, you can't go with the little Marcos and the Lion Ted. I don't really think you can do that. And the gender thing does make a difference, I believe. I don't think you take on a woman on the stage. Now, I understand that it sounds like a gender component to it, but I just think the dynamic is different. Look, you saw it when she tried to take on Carly Fiorina. I mean, there is a dynamic. I think that has to be respected.
Yeah, especially.
And she was Secretary of State.
Especially given that she is more experienced and more knowledgeable about the policy issues and the process. I would, if I was going to make a suggestion to the Trump team, it would be around focus on you. Don't focus on attacking her, but give the viewers, the voters, some sense that you have a vision for where you want the country to go and how you would get the country there. Because if he goes into attack mode against her, he's going to be in trouble.
Well, he's going to have to develop those programs and ideas before he gets there. He doesn't have a lot of them. He is on the answer is the attack mode. So when he attacks her for saying, let's just go with a couple of things he's going to do, you voted for the Iraq war, I imagine part of what she says is, well, so did your running mate, and you had the option of picking anybody, and you picked a guy who voted for the Iraq war too. And of course, Trump has been caught with that, where he just says, basically, it's okay for Pence, it's not okay for Hillary.
Right. And that's in a primary debate format, that would be okay. People go, oh, okay, that's fine. But more sophisticated voters in the general election are going to know that sort of makes sense, what she's saying.
On the Benghazi issue, he's going to say that she allowed the murder of four Americans. And, of course, he's just going to, you know, basically Donald Trump's prep is the Internet, right? I mean, it's the Internet, it's TV. And I'm not saying that he says that. When he's asked how he prepares, he says he watches the shows. So
right.
He doesn't say I read briefing books or books. So when he goes after for Benghazi, I mean, once again, and that's a tough issue for her, but she's going to look pretty good as she begins to say, you know what, Mr. Trump, I wonder in your TV watching whether you watched the 11 hours that I testified before Congress and paid attention to it and saw that they got nothing out of me, basically, that they didn't know. And those were in the words of Trey Gowdy. I mean, basically, she will sound a lot more knowledgeable and sophisticated, even about one of her worst marks, because I don't think he'll have the substantive preparation to go after it.
Right. And he won't have the substantive preparation because he lacks, I think, the fundamental curiosity about the even knowing the questions to ask. I mean, when you're running for president, it seems like you should become a pretty voracious consumer of information about the job. And he hasn't demonstrated that at all in this entire cycle.
Well, I think that's right, and it remains to be seen. These debates are going to be very closely watched. Could be determinative of what people do. They may be waiting to see them mano a mano. And Philip Everly, professor at Chicago State University of Political Science, come back and join me after a debate or two so we can take another look and see just how accurate we are in our thoughts.
I will indeed, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. Time for another installment of incredible theater going on in the Chicagoland area. Now, oftentimes I talk about theaters themselves. We talked about the Steppenwolf and Looking Glass, and you sort of like the mission of the theaters. Once in a while, you come across a show where you really have to focus in on an incredible performance, an incredible storyline. I wanted to do that today. The show Rose is playing over at Greenhouse Theater Center, directed by Steve Scott, and it's playing through September 25th. Is the story of Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy. That would be the mom of all the Kennedys. Depending on your age, you know who that is. Perhaps you have lots of strong memories of her. But if you're not as old, perhaps, as some of us, then maybe it's just a name that is historical for you. But I want you to meet the woman who's playing Rose Kennedy in such a powerful and meaningful way that I just had to talk to her. Linda Ryder is well known to Chicago audiences for so long. I remember, I won't say I first saw her, but I do remember the performance she did, another a solo performance in The Testament of Mary, which was so incredibly powerful at Victory Gardens Theater. That stayed with me for so long. No surprise that she received a Joseph Jefferson nomination, and she's done so many shows here and other places. But now she's playing Rose, and I got to talk to her about this. Linda, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Nice to be here. And you should be my agent, maybe.
Yeah, I said, well, I might be better than the agent I have, so for myself. No, I have to tell you, we're not going to talk about The Testament of Mary, but you were incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's talk about Rose.
All right.
Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, and I couldn't wait for this. I see a lot of plays, but I really couldn't wait for this because I am a huge, you know, Kennedy clan fan, grew up with the Kennedys. Of course, there's pluses and minuses to the family as time goes on, as we learn so many things. But Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, the matriarch who started it all, in terms of guiding these children. Talk to me a little bit about Rose Kennedy and how you understand her. Who is Rose Kennedy to you, the woman who plays her?
Well, to me, she's very different from me and from most women of today's age. Very, very strong woman, but that's very different from what we consider a strong woman today. She put up with a lot with her marriage and her husband's philandering and just didn't say a word about it, put up with everything, did as he wanted her to do, and raised the children in the direction that he wanted them raised, basically. The fact that she could put up with all of that and keep and so many children and keep it all together after so many triumphs and so many tragedies is just incredible to me. So, you know, I certainly look up to her. It's an honor to be portraying her. I don't know, you know, women today that could do what she did. And
I wanted to ask you about, look, she comes from a very different time. She was born, I think, in 1890, and she was married in, I mean, you say these dates in the show, 1914, I think it was.
Yes.
I might have that wrong, but I think that's about right. My point is a very different era and a very different time. And I was sort of curious as we sort of blend today, and as you were reading the script and reading the woman you were about to become on stage for about 90 minutes, I mean, did you look and just – did you have respect for her? Did you have empathy for her? Did you get angry at her? And we'll talk about some of the stories that she lived through, but how did you feel about Rose Kennedy? Was she just a product of her times? Could she be Rose Kennedy today?
I don't know. When I first read it, yeah, I didn't – it kind of angered me, I have to say, and I didn't understand it. But when you go back and think about the times and the fact that she was extremely religious, her father sent her to a Catholic school, a year in college in Holland, Sacred Hearts Convent School in Holland. Her faith, she was already Catholic, but got very strong, and she was extremely religious. With all that being said, I mean, she... And it's in the play where she went through a very hard time. When they first married, they were very much in love, and it's like any story of a love story where they fell in love and they had to tell each other everything, and, you know, a very sweet beginning. But then things started falling apart with World War One, and the fact that Joe got a deferment and did not go to war, and I think it changed him very much, and everything changed in their marriage. And she does talk about the fact that she did go to her father and say she wanted a divorce, but he wouldn't let her do it. So there's that.
Yeah.
And, you know, so she wanted out at one point, like any woman would, I think, when she talks about what she was going through at that point.
But she couldn't go.
But no, I mean, and now she says, but now I see he was right, you know, because I would have been denied the sacraments of the church and I would have been ostracized by all my loved ones, you know. So she's glad she made up her mind to stay with him, but she also made up her mind at that point. But she wasn't just going to sit back and feel sorry for herself. She was going to make a life for herself, and that's what she did, very separate from Joe's, very, you know, separate. She took care of the houses and the children, and she traveled a lot and dressed well. And
very much so.
Paris for a month every spring for her clothes. I mean, she did what she wanted to do. She decided if she's going to stick with this, then she'll do it on her terms in some way and just put up with whatever he did.
And indeed, she sort of refers to the fact that, you know, these Kennedy men are Kennedy men. You just have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to be mistresses, and oh, there's so much that goes on in this play.
Mm-hmm.
But and the religious piece, in fact, the premise of the way this show is presented is that it's just after Chappaquiddick. I don't think I'm ruining anything. I mean, we learned that fairly early in the show.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And she's waiting. Teddy is out, and she's, you know, worried about Teddy. It's just after Chappaquiddick, where Mary Jo Kopechne was killed. And so who
mm-hmm.
knows what he's up to. She's waiting for him to come home or call, and every time the phone rings, she grabs it, and it's one of the other kids calling.
Right.
But there's one time the phone rings, and she doesn't get it. I'm talking about the religious piece, because what is she doing when the phone rings and she won't get it?
Mm-hmm. She's praying.
She's doing the rosary.
Mm-hmm.
And that shocked me, because I thought, all right, first of all, I'm Jewish, so maybe I would have reacted
differently. Well, when I first read it, I thought the same thing. This isn't believable. If she's so worried, she'd go to the phone. And, you know, everyone else around me who was Catholic in the room for the reading went, oh, no, no.
She wouldn't. Is it really powerful? The story, listen, you don't have to know anything about the Kennedys to know that she's the mother of President John Kennedy, Senator Bobby Kennedy, Senator Ted Kennedy. The world knows that. There are other Kennedy children. And the story that has always angered me, that I didn't know as a little kid, but angered me as the years went on, maybe you can just briefly sort of reference it. There's a daughter named Rosemary. And we learn a lot in this show. We hear a lot about Rosemary. We see photographs projected on the wall so that we're taken through a journey, not just through your words and Rose Kennedy's words, but through photographs projected. But tell me the piece about Rosemary. I don't know. It angered me. I don't know if that piece of the Kennedy story angers you.
Oh, well, very much so. But yes, it does. But again, you have to understand the times, not only the way Joe was, the fact that he was very motivated to push his sons forward politically. He didn't really have time for any of his girls so much. He was about the men, you know, and that was kind of understood in the family. The girls, they became mothers and wives, you know, and that's the way Rose taught them, you know. And so at the time, not only was Rosemary a girl, but she was slow. She was mentally retarded, as what they referred to it then. And at that time, nobody talked about that. There was really nothing discussed, or a lot of families with the same issues, you just didn't talk about it.
And again, it's history.
There was no place for them. They kept putting her in convents and things like that.
And then took a tremendous step.
Mm-hmm.
What ultimately, again, we're not ruining anything, it's history.
Right. So, yeah, most people are aware of this. So I didn't know that Joe did this without telling Rose. Apparently, it's not so much in the script, but I found out later that they did talk about it, but he didn't tell her he was doing it. He just brought it up, the possibility of a lobotomy, which was very new at the time, had only been done on 500 people in the whole world at that time. And those were patients, though, with very serious mental disturbances, nothing like retardation. And so Joe apparently brought it up to her at one point, but that was it. And Rose, you know, did not want to do that, but Joe did it anyway.
And they lied to the other kids about it.
Yeah, right.
Your sister's off teaching.
And then, of course, the procedure was a disaster. I don't know if you want me to go into the details of it, but
well, no, I want to save some because people are going to come see this show. But
yeah, I do in the play. I talk about it in detail, and it was really horrible, horrible. And Rose did not know that he had taken her to do this, so it was done. And of course, she was much worse. Instead of having a mental capacity of, what they say, like a 9 or 10 year old, she was reduced to infancy. She could no longer speak or walk after the anything.
Just tragic. Now, can I ask?
Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to ask you just a bit of an unfair question, and then we'll see if you can answer it. It's just a little unfair. There is actually one, and I'll tell you why I'm asking this in a minute. All the kids check in except one. We don't hear from one of the Kennedy children. And I don't know if you talked about this in terms of putting the show together, but were you aware of which Kennedy child did not call in to Rose?
Jean.
Yes. Jean Kennedy Smith.
Yes.
I wasn't.
That's all I know.
Yeah. Well. Don't worry about that because I actually had a conversation about who didn't call in with the artistic director of the Greenhouse Theater with Jacob Harvey, who of course is responsible for creating these lineups of shows. And the reason I said it was unfair is because Jacob's actually joining us now in our conversation. So I wanted to hear he's impressed now. You knew that answer. Hi, Jacob. I can admit that you're with us now. How are you?
Hey, Paul, how's it going?
Good. What? Linda got it, huh? I mean, that was good.
Linda got it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Jacob, can you share with us, because I know you know kind of the underlying aspect of this stay, the script written by Lawrence Lehmer. Why wasn't Jean Kennedy Smith, why doesn't she call in?
Well, you know, I can't really exactly speak to the specifics of why she doesn't call in into the course of the play. Or through the action of the play. I mean, the play is based off of these series of interviews or these tapes that Larry had from Mr. Coughlin, who ghost wrote Rose's autobiography. And so a lot of it sort of takes place from there, and I think a lot of it also has to do with being those who are most connected to Rose and those who are most connected to Teddy in the course of this incident. So, you know, the theatrical or sort of the narrative device through the play is, you know, those who call in are, you know, Jackie, who is very close with Rose, and there's, you know, lots of talk between about Jack and Jackie, but, you know, those also closely tied into Teddy and, you know, wanting to.
So a different kind of relationship. Let me ask, by the way, you sort of references, but we should put this out there. The lines that Linda reads so incredibly beautifully throughout the show, these are not, well, I can't speak to this 100%. They're not made up lines. These are based in history. And share with the audience where you kind of referenced it, but where is this script coming from?
Well, the script is coming from the words that Larry wrote. You know, Lawrence Lehmer, who is the playwright, is a Kennedy scholar, and he's published you know, many
14 books
on the Kennedy family, including the Kennedy women. And as part of his research for the Kennedy women, he had these tapes of Rose being interviewed for her autobiography. And these tapes as he put it, sort of sat on a shelf for a little while. And in conversations with Larry, you know, he told me that he started listening to them, and the voice of Rose kept speaking to him, and he kept hearing these tapes and was, you know, compelled to turn it into a play because the life is so dynamic, and it's such an important story to tell.
Linda, you're no...
Some of it, though, I mean, he did write the play, of course, but there are some of the things, lines in there are verbatim, I know, because when we sat down for a reading, there are a few things that we changed here and there in the beginning, and I would bring something up, and he goes, but that's verbatim, that's summer tape. So,
but she actually said that, Linda.
Quotes, yeah.
I want to ask you, Linda, and this is really a compliment to, as well, to Steve Scott, the director of this show, but, you know, you have to maintain an audience's interest for, I think it was about 87 minutes, call it 90 minutes, as the show went on. You know, a one-woman, and you've done it before, as I said, you're no stranger to solo performance, but how much of a responsibility, burden, challenge is that as an actress to you to say, you know, if we don't maintain audience attention here, I can't blame anybody else. It's me, as you move around that living room set.
It's a lot of pressure, I have to tell you. It's a lot of pressure. The more I do it, the more familiar I get with it, you know, the easier that is, and the more enjoyable, in an odd sense, because it's very tragic, a lot of it, but the more enjoyable it is, the better I can tell the story, and make it personal and fun, and when it can be fun, and sad when it can be sad, and the more I can make it real and personal, the more I enjoy telling the story and doing it. But it is a lot of pressure, especially in the very beginning, when, like I said, you're learning the Mary show, the Testament of Mary. I had that for probably about 5 or 6 months before I started it, so I was off book before I even started rehearsals. This, I was cramming the lines, and I was probably about halfway through it before I started rehearsal, so it was definitely a little bit harder on me as far as that goes.
Okay, Jacob, so, you're creating too heavy of a schedule.
It was a little scarier going into previews and opening when I was like, oh my God, am I going to remember these lines? But knock wood, I did all right. So.
Well, you did. Well, I'll tell you what, if you didn't, I didn't catch you. Yeah, you did a fantastic job. And I also have to say, I ask one other question about the performance. Rose Kennedy, everybody knows Rose Kennedy was stoic and strong. I mean, to lose all the children that she did, I don't think anybody ever saw her cry in public. You actually talk about that. In the show. But I'm just curious, were the strength of Rose Kennedy, was that something you felt in her character? Were you directed that way by Steve Scott? Is there direction in the script from Lawrence Lehmer? Did Jacob show up and say, I want to see strength there? What took you to present her as the stoic figure we know her to be?
Well, because she was. I mean, that's what everybody says, and that's the way she was. And of course, this is a hard time for her, as you said. Teddy's missing, and she's bringing all of this up because she says at the beginning of the play, "This is a different day for me. I need to find out why it has all come to this, to Chappaquiddick. What about our lives has led us to all these tragedies and now this?" So she brings up photo album she hasn't looked at in years, and she's bringing all this up, things she's kept suppressed. She said, I never think about the deaths of my sons. I never ask questions all my life. I just don't. She just tunes it all out. And now she's purposefully bringing this all up, not only because she's talking to the man writing her autobiography, but for herself personally, she wants to kind of bring it all up, catharsis, you know. And so this day, as she's talking and going through all this and getting angrier and angrier about things that she never, that she didn't do things maybe in a different way, that sort of thing. She's getting angrier and angrier. And in the play today that she's talking to this man, she is getting emotional, and she does allow herself some tears, and which she might not have done, you know, in real life had she been on an interview with somebody. But certainly still she's trying to maintain, and it just becomes kind of harder and harder as you get towards the end of the play.
No question. Well, yeah. The show, it's called Rose. It is playing, as I said, at Greenhouse Theater Center through September 25th. Jacob, that's still the close date, right?
That is right.
Okay, just wanted to be sure. Through September 25th. But actually, briefly, Jacob, we're going to talk about this some other interview. But for folks who say, wow, I've got to see Linda do this role, how phenomenal to see a solo performance. The truth is, this is actually part of a series, a solo celebration series. So if you are all about one-person performances, you got to check out Greenhouse Theater, right?
That's right. That's right. We also have a wonderful production playing right now until September 10th called Bloodshot, which is a film noir mystery written by Chicago playwright Douglas Post. And I'm actually directing a play in the series that goes into previews this week called I Do Today, which is a beautiful exploration of Judaism, queer theory, and marriage. So that's exciting.
And there's a total of 12 plays going on in this Solo Celebration series. I'll encourage people to go to the website, which is greenhousetheater.org. That's theater spelled E-R, by the way, not the more appropriate British R-E, I might add. But greenhousetheater.org. Don't you agree, Linda, we should be spelling it
out?
Yes,
I do.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Folks,
I want to encourage you to see Linda in the show Rose. It is, I think, one of the most stellar performances of the year. I don't make tough decisions and all that, but if I were giving out awards, man, I'd be giving you one. So I just want to congratulate you on another stellar performance, because I've seen you in other roles. Congratulations to you and Jacob Harvey. Thanks for joining us as well, the artistic director of the Greenhouse Theater. Check out Rose, everybody, greenhousetheater.org. It's a show not to be missed. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.